This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty, downtown Vancouver. And really excited for today. We've got a bit of a debate, a tete-a-tete with Eric Villa-Gomez.
A dialogue, if you will.
A dialogue. Eric Villa-Gomez and Bo Jarvis. Eric Villa-Gomez, for our listeners, lecturer at UBC SCARP program. Independent researcher, editor in chief for Spacing Vancouver. So very involved in housing and also in urban planning and in academic, but a jack of all trades. So yeah, wears a lot of hats. Bo Jarvis, of course, past guest fan favorite. He is the president and CEO of West Group, one of Western Canada's largest development companies, privately owned development companies. Matt, this is a great conversation.
Let me set this up for you, Adam, because there's been, as anyone that's following the housing conversation in Vancouver, there have been dueling public letters to Mark Carney that have been released. One such letter was from a group of housing experts, mainly academics. Eric Villa-Gomez is one of the people who signed that letter that had a very distinct take on where we're at, what's causing the housing crisis, how we can move forward. And then there was a letter from the development community. Notably, Bo did not sign that letter, but there was a letter that I think, let's say Bo's kind of representing that side, the industry side, that had a very different take on where we're at, what needs to be done now to get out of this crisis in the industry in which not a lot's getting built, and what the causes are, what the solutions are. So we decided to have representatives of both sides on. And like you said, to debate or maybe to find common ground. And we'll leave it to the listener to decide on where we landed there.
Some of my favorite conversations during this episode kind of circled around, what is a housing expert? How do we get to affordability? Conversations around supply and demand, and can we build our way out of this? Lots of just interesting takes.
My favorite part was when Eric Villa-Gomez actually cited your Quackery article and actually said he'd read it and was going to offer a critique, but we didn't get that far.
Yeah,
he did his homework though. Let's put it that way. Eric did his homework.
I'm too fragile to take critiques from 30 years ago. The good thing is this is like the first time we've ever had, I think, like a postmodern take on housing
right
on the show. There's a lot of talk about power and culture and stuff that I think, we'll see how it lands. We'll see how the audience absorbs it. I'm sure there's some listeners that will be able to kind of apply it to a certain situation. So very interesting, different perspectives.
Two different perspectives. We'll leave it at that. The first part is today. Looking forward to it. Great conversation. Before we get to that, Adam, we have this segment that remains nameless.
Yes, Matt, the segment that remains nameless. And I believe you have a trivia question today.
I do. And this is a shout out to friend of the show, Brendan Augmentson, posted a chart that I'll try and derive a trivia question for you this week. So he posted a chart that had pricing from 2014 through to the peaks of 2022 and till today in both Vancouver and Toronto. And I think, I would hope most of our listeners know, Vancouver is not Toronto. Okay. At the national level, I think that's a little less known, but I think people on the ground in Vancouver understand this very much. But the question I have for you, Adam, is since peaking in 2022, Greater Toronto's apartment prices have declined much more than Vancouver. But the question for you is, how many times more? So I can tell you it's more than 100%.
Ooh.
How many times more have Greater Toronto apartment prices declined since 2022 of February?
I'm going to go with...
Oh, Adam, before you get to that, we have a hot new listing over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com that I want to tell you about. This is one in one of my favorite buildings downtown, The Max. Have you ever seen a contingency reserve fund like The Max's, Adam? I think they're almost approaching $3 million, right. Almost approaching $3 million in the CRF. It's unbelievable. This unit is, yeah. And I don't want to lead with the CRF. That's not the way I approach things generally.
Yeah, but, come on. Nobody, everyone's wondering what you're talking
3106
about.
3106-928 Beatty Street. This is in Yale Town. This is a little studio apartment. Unbelievable. Burrard Inlet. North Shore Mountain views. It's what I'd call a sky home, Adam. 31st floor. It has parking. It has outdoor space. There is absolutely no wasted space. Updated appliances, updated flooring, new laundry. This is ideal for a first-time home buyer who wants to live that Yale Town lifestyle or an investor. I think the last number of, there's been tenants in this for the last number of years, all from Amazon, Adam. They just trade it one after another.
Makes sense.
Brilliant young Amazon employees. 3106-928 Beatty. First open houses this weekend. You can check it out over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And of course, Adam, while you're there, click sell with us.
Yeah, Matt. Yeah, Amazon, you just one click and they send a tenant. It's nice. Here's the thing about bachelor units is highest price per foot typically when they sell and highest price per foot when they rent. So definitely a good product to have as an investment, or if you're a first-time home buyer, it's perfect for a perfect location, right?
The amenities in this building too, it's worth pointing out, really nice gym, really nice pool, 24-hour concierge, meeting rooms, sauna, steam, you name it, they got it.
We get it, Matt. You're holding on to the fob and you're using it at your leisure. We get it. Okay.
I even have the visitor parking pass.
Yeah, exactly. So how can people find out more about this listing?
I told you, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, Adam. You click sell with us there. You get the sold plan. Start on launch date. This is our step-by-step program to get your home or property ready for sale. We can definitely help with that, but you're going to get top dollar in the shortest amount of time using the sold plan. That's at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But back to our quiz question, Adam. So to remind you, Greater Toronto's apartment prices have declined much more drastically than Greater Vancouver. The question is, how many times more have they declined?
I'm going with, I'm going to say 2x.
Interesting. I always say you're very good at these quizzes. A little off this week. 4 times is the answer, Adam.
Wow.
Vancouver apartments are down since the peak of 2022, about 5 to 6%. Toronto, 21 to 22%. And I want to thank Brendan Augmentson for doing the work. But just another reminder that, we often, at least in the national headlines, you see Toronto and Vancouver talking about, the crisis in the condo market. And it is orders of magnitude in terms of the difference.
Yeah.
So we'll leave it there.
Well, what that means, and I mean, we've been saying this for years, but what it really means is if you're an investor or buyer in Vancouver, prices have shown a lot more stickiness. So the downside, the risk is quite a bit lower in Vancouver. And we've seen that time and time again when the markets tend to shift. Vancouver has always been a very resilient market for people holding real estate. So just, again, I'm not surprised, but I can't believe I undershot it so much.
Yeah, public service announcement. I can't believe you did either, Adam. And I think you'd actually seen the chart.
Yeah, Matt, I saw the post, but my finger was already swiping before I read the fine print here. So
fair enough. Well, let's cut to our dialogue or conversation with Eric Villagomez and Bo Jarvis.
Really enjoy this. So part one, enjoy.
The Five Wire is brought to you by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been recognized as Multifamily Home Builder of the Year for 10 years in a row and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with two fitness areas, three children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
Okay, so we're here with Eric Villagomez. He's a UBC lecturer at the School of Community and Regional Planning, and Bo Jarvis, President and CEO of West Group. Thanks so much for taking the time, gentlemen, and for joining us on the show.
It's an honor and a pleasure to come here and to potentially get more haters. more haters.
Or lovers.
Or lovers. Maybe
you never
lovers.
Know.
I'm a lover and a hater, so so it's all good there.
Yeah, and Bo, of course, you've been on the show before. We would refer to you as a past guest fan favorite. Eric, your first time. Hopefully we'll have you back. But maybe I should say, Eric, we and Bo are you both signed, although Bo, did you actually sign that letter?
No. Which one?
Yeah. Okay.
Let's start at that. Fundamentals. Let's go back to the basics.
Yeah. Multiple letters have been signed, and I'm sure we'll come
that is
out.
That is accurate.
One from a bunch of planners and academics, primarily out of UBC, and then the other from the development community, outlining very different viewpoints, I would say, or perspectives on the housing crisis here in Vancouver, what's caused it, and what it will take to get out of it, and what this moment actually represents, I think. But that's all to say, Eric, it's your first time on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, it's an honor to be here. For me, I'm always what they call filler. That's really what I always, when people say, what the heck do you do? I'm like, I'm filler. I usually just fill in gaps where people need it. So I do a lot of things. I do a lot of reading, writing, teaching, designing. I have a practice. I do a lot of research, but it's independent research. So hence the kind of the lecturer title. So I'm not officially a professor. I'm a lecturer, which means that it kind of spans both practice and research. So I'm kind of all over the place, even with the research that I do. And a lot of it, I would say, hinges on cities and how they evolve and change. So, but for the purposes, I believe here, I'm associated, of course, with the School of Community and Regional Planning at the University of British Columbia. And a lot of the writing that I do that's linked somewhat to this letter deals with a lot of the writing I do on Spacing Vancouver. I'm the editor-in-chief there.
Perfect. And Bo, can you remind us of yourself?
we were not a signatory to the letter that came out from the developers that around the same time as the letter that came out from the housing experts. Bo Jarvis, president and CEO of West Group Properties, past chair of Urban Development Institute. I like how you described yourself as filler. I don't know how I'd describe myself. Yeah. And so we are one of Western Canada's or Canada's largest privately held real estate development companies and asset management companies, and very, very involved in advocacy around our industry and trying to, I would say, established more alignment within the industry as well as members of the general public.
And I might add something that is going to blow probably the minds of even several students. I usually hold this close to the chest here, but it's a connection between you and I, because I actually used to be a sponsored skateboarder. Whoa. Back in the day.
I was.
And,
oh my God. Okay.
I thought I'd throw that bomb out there already. Let's just start this and just throw something out there that nobody knows.
Sponsored.
Yeah, that changes everything.
I was going to say, so Adam and I are the only two here that aren't very good at some skiing, snowboarding, skateboarding.
There we go. I could grind a curb, Matt.
50-50.
Only 5-0. That's the harder one.
For a first question, and maybe we'll start with Eric. One thing, and it was Douglas Todd in a Douglas Todd piece that kind of outlined the two letters, that we referenced here. Started it by saying there's two very distinct visions outlined in these two letters. One by a number of housing experts and the other by developers. And I was struck by the distinction there, developers and housing experts. Eric, what in your mind makes a housing expert, and who should we be listening to when it comes to solving our housing crisis?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And I want to be clear that a lot of even the distinction between the two is really outside, I would argue, and maybe you might disagree, Bo, but outside even of both groups. We never, like the quote-unquote housing expert group, never labeled ourselves housing experts, to my knowledge. But it was something that once it kind of went out there, it just took on a life of its own, as things do. So I don't consider myself an expert of anything. As I mentioned before, I'm filler. And I do a lot of, again, reading, researching. And if that qualifies me as an expert, sure. Do I know more about some things than other people? Okay. But I think in many ways, it's kind of like a false distinction. And I know, Bo, you wound up going, and I believe you even wrote that on LinkedIn, and you wrote the question, and it seemed genuine. It's like, no, like I want to know. And I was going through all the different responses, and there was one that struck me because it was just so on the nose. And it wound up saying, short paraphrasing, it was only two sentences anyway, it said, you know what? Stop bickering about uselessness and get to collaboration. And it just period. And I was like, yeah, okay, that's right on the nose, right? So I think that to me is an important kind of variables. And I think that comes from the fact that I think cities now really defy single experts. I think there are just so many facets to cities and housing that no single discipline, I would argue, can take charge of it and claim it as kind of their own. And it's really a kind of mix between all of these different perspectives. So I think I love Todd, Douglas Todd, and his work, I think, is great. But I think, again, there was a little bit of, and I don't think it was purposeful per se, but I just think that this distinction obviously caused a series of fires, and it happened all the way across, social media. And it's like, what's an expert? Who are you? Why are you saying you're an expert? Other people defining what an expert is. And it's kind of like, look, why are we even wasting our time on this? Let's just get actually to the problem instead of just figuring out names. But so that's my kind of take on it. And it takes everything from developers, from architects, from people who know finance, from ecologists, all the way through to really understand what's happening.
Oh, and maybe I'll reframe it then, because I think that the collaborative piece is useful, and take it however, in whatever direction you want. Why? And I guess I won't put it on Douglas Todd, but it does strike me as why do these distinctions kind of emerge? Maybe because there's some sort of, they gain hold of the general public for a reason, right?
Yeah.
Why is it?
Oh, it's a complex question. So first of all, one of my favorite sayings about experts is that an expert has failed more than a beginner has ever tried. And so, what is an expert? Am I an expert? Is Eric an expert? I have no idea. I know I've failed a lot. But I guess, Douglas Todd's article. So our industry has been, over the course of 20 years, let's say, faced with increasing levels of complexity, unprecedented levels of government intervention by all levels of government, unprecedented levels of armchair quarterbacking as the affordability crisis has emerged as, and gained, you know, significant steam. And so everybody's got an opinion, whether you're at the dinner table, you got academics, you got researchers, you got people who are actually building houses, you got on and on and on. And what I started to, what I have observed is that we have started to distinguish experts and developers and categorize them separately. And over the last 20 years, those of us who are building homes on the ground have, I would say, generated a unique set of skills with respect to understanding policy, in some cases better than the policymakers themselves in terms of interpretation. We have enormous amounts of data that we now use and understand and have available to us as evidence of what policy perhaps is working and isn't. And so with all of that being said, we consistently have a difficulty getting what I just call a seat at the table. And this is always an example of this is during recent federal pre-budget consultation, I had to beg to get a seat at the table when they came to Vancouver with a number of ministers and aides. And we were the only home builder at the table. And it was pre-budget consultation on the housing problem. And every single other person at the table was a so-called expert, academic, nonprofit, housing advocate of some sort. And I just started to sort of, okay, like, why is this happening? And why this distinction? And how do you define a housing expert? Which is, and then that article came out by Douglas Todd that actually, you know, distinguished between the two. And it was right around the time those letters were signed. And so I threw it out on LinkedIn and asked the question. And again, I did try and be genuine and ask for some respectful debate. And I think there was a lot of respectful debate on there. And it was respectfully polarized. And I remember the comment that you mentioned, Eric, where it said, can't you guys just, you know, like, forget about this and let's get together and collaborate, which I fundamentally agree with, right? Like, we have to become, we are so divided and polarized right now as it relates to not only a general society, but housing for sure. And we have to come together. We got to find common ground and unite. So, yeah.
For a lot of people listening, Bo, a developer not having a seat at the table might be surprising, though. Why do you think that it hasn't happened, or why is there a resistance?
It's contrary to popular belief for sure, right? I think that a lot of people have felt that the development community has in fact influenced policy. And you know, you always hear, oh, the Vancouver Council are in the pockets of the developer. I mean, it is so, it's laughable because it's so far from the truth. You know, if we had politicians in our pockets, we wouldn't be, you know, pumping out development right now where it would have made more sense for us to deploy our capital into a GIC over the same duration, you know? And so I think that there's always been this lack of trust, right? And I'm going to say this too, and I've said it before. I think the development community, you know, over generations have perpetuated that lack of trust. I think it's really only in the last couple of decades where developers have started to become more values-based as organizations, you know, award-winning employers, and really like trying to do better in the community, trying to understand social outcomes as well as profitability, right? Whereas before it was likely mostly profitability. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of change and we've just had a difficult time, I guess, fighting that stigma that in fact was perpetuated by our industry over time.
Yeah. And I think, well, I definitely appreciate all those points. I do think that there's a kind of different facet as well, that there is a historical lineage to this that kind of goes back. And maybe I'll throw another bomb later on. I'll leave it in the pocket for now. But I think that there is a history of that I think you rightfully recognize. I think that there are lobbyists that are directly connected, that continue to be directly connected to the development industry that are very clearly a part of it. And as new things start coming out, like I think a new FOI came out and landed on my digital desk. And you know, looking at the names, they're part of the same industries, right? It's like, you know, you have the real estate industries, you have development industries. And so it's not that there's lack of evidence per se, I think. And I think that I think a lot of this, and this is where, you know, we might we're going to see where this is going to go. But again, I'm going to keep any bombs here right now. It's still early days. So,
oh God, I think
I think it goes back and it predates us by at least really two centuries. Like a lot of the stuff that winds up happening is happening before we're even part of this game. We're not even on this planet, right? That all these different types of power structures are getting formalized in ways that are very, very subtle. And there's a subtlety to it. And it, I know you both know it. And I'm talking right now. And the reason why I know is because I read both of your theses on it. Now, there's the subtleties that wind up going into kind of myth-making and all different types of different populations being kind of, and perspectives being exalted over others. And this is kind of commonplace. And I would say it's not new to cities now. It's been there across the board. But I think that the kind of dangerous piece is, and what I've tried to write about a lot, especially recently, is the hidden systems that are in there. The stuff that we don't recognize, that we're kind of like, oh, you know, that's nothing. And it's part of different bureaucratic machinery. Like even something as simple as applying for a permit. And what does that mean? And these are the things that I think you'll agree are getting increasingly complicated, right? I was recently meeting with a developer and I was telling him my story of, I was trying to do, again, here's the practitioner side. I was trying to do a 100 square foot addition to a house. You know, I was like, clear. It's effectively an oversized closet. And it took me 2 years to get a permit, right? So I appreciate, again, on that side, I'm like, this is just insanity, let alone for someone waiting 9 years for a permit, rezonings, all types of stuff go out the window. Even in that 2 years, you know, the construction costs of that just so happened over that time, construction costs elevated, you know, the effectively the pro forma exploded, right? And the clients are losing their minds. I'm losing my mind. So there's that side of the puzzle. And you can wind up saying, you know, is someone at fault? Well, you can't pinpoint really one. It's a system that is actually kind of at fault and that we've kind of allowed to come. And now we're seeing, I think, the systemic issues coming to heads, like really coming to heads now. And I would say again, the 90s and the early 2000s for the development industry were beautiful, right? They were great stuff. And now it's coming to heads. All of these other things, all the different things that are coming in, environmental issues, social issues that are starting to actually, and that both of you wonderfully contributed to in kind of the work that you've done, you know, in some way, like not directly, but just in terms of culture is changing, right? Like how we understand culture is changing. And we're seeing that coming to heads now. And I think the development industry, because of that long lineage that again predates West Group, it just has that reputation that's very difficult to shake, because once it's kind of there and once even something seemingly benign goes into the world, this is what happens. And behind the scenes, this machinery is working, sometimes not necessarily directly with the knowledge of specific developers, but when you zoom out, it's like, oh, okay, actually there are things that are happening there that are affecting this in this way.
So if I understand, Eric, we're talking about kind of the mistrust in the development community, and basically, Bo, you're agreeing in some ways that there's this long history of
monopoly, man.
Yes. but there's also really interesting, because the discussion within the group of signatories has been, I know it looks like there are signatories, but it's been very divided in many ways in the back, because we not only have academics, we have people into the development industry, we have architects who are putting really their livelihood on the line to sign these things. And if you look across, I think we're on our third letter, not everyone is signing all of them, right? Some people are, even within the group, it's like, actually, no, I don't agree with what you're saying here, and I'm not going to sign this, because it is an issue. And again, when you start, I think, you know, it's been a weird thing for me to say. I get this with students all the time, because they're, you know, students are always looking for, you know, easy answers. And it's like, you know, who's wrong and who's right? I'm like, you know what? Everyone is wrong simultaneously and everyone is right simultaneously. Depending on where you narrow your scope, it's kind of like all of this makes sense. So if you take the development perspective, you look at performas, just like I wound up saying for my projects, performas have exploded because of this. Like it's like, and I'm writing them, I understand the assumptions behind them and the biases of them. And sometimes the way that the complicated nature of the way that the bureaucratic machine currently works, it just doesn't make sense. So, you know, when people, I've been attacked multiple times with my writing. It's like, you know, show me the performer, Eric, show me the, and I'm like, I understand performance as much as the rest of the person. I understand that there are assumptions behind such performance, and I'm not discrediting the performer per se. I'm potentially discrediting the assumptions behind the performer, but I believe the numbers. I believe the numbers because I'm actually doing the numbers and they're not working either, right? So it's kind of like this weird place. So I don't think mistrust, at least I can't say that, speak for the development side of things, but I could say for the signatories, because of the diversity of the people in there, I don't think that there's a mistrust. I think that there are different perspectives on the same issue, but I don't think that anyone's saying like what you are saying is invalid. You know what I mean? So I don't know about that specific word. And I don't think if all the signatories were here, and maybe there would be some that are like, I don't trust these people at all. But my general sense is because the diversity of the people, that it's not necessarily a mistrust. It's just, we are looking at this in a slightly different way.
But there's a clear division amongst, call it the developers, and some of the signatories of that group, of the original letter. And so I'll say this for the listeners. I mean, you know, Eric wrote an op-ed and I wrote a fiery email to Eric, you know, saying like, where are you getting this information from? You're not considering this. You're not considering that. Probably overly emotional in tone. And Eric engaged immediately. And we just kept engaging. And, you know, and since then we've had 2.5 hour one-on-one meetings where we're just like talking and going through stuff. And, you know, and which I really, really appreciate about Eric. That's with right. This said, there are some people in that group who don't want to be questioned. They continue to perpetuate a narrative that when you just scratch the surface, you find significant errors in their work and are able to dismantle their position in an instant. And those people are being touted, in particular by the media, who continues to call them as housing experts. And this is what I've said, and Eric and I have talked about this. When we go back to the word trust, right? So when information is put out there by Bo Jarvis, or information is put out there by Eric or one of the, you know, the experts that signed that letter, there's a higher level of trust with someone coming from, you know, lecturer at UBC, PhD, you know, demographer, whatever it is, than there is Bo Jarvis, CEO of West Group. And so I believe that there's a higher duty of care required and a higher duty of responsibility by those so-called experts to be using factual data, to be open to debate and discussion, to allow questions. And many of them, they shut the door, right? Yet they continue to take the calls from media. And that's what I really, really struggle with. And we're finding that all the time, right? There's advocates or experts on housing that continue to advocate for rent control, you know, and I brought some, like the Journal of Housing Economics in 2023 published a meta study that went through, I think it was up to 60 published and unpublished studies over the last of, you know, several decades that yielded negative long-term results to sustainable production of purpose-built rental housing. That's like the first meta study. And so with all of the advocates for rent control, I just want to have a simple conversation about this. I want to go through it with them and I want to talk about it and I want to learn, what am I missing? What's this study missing in your opinion? And I could go on and on, but I think that that's one of the fundamental issues right now, is this sort of, this lack of engagement and working to find common ground. Look, there's an old scientist philosopher, his name's Karl Popper, and he believed in something called provisional knowledge. And that means effectively that all knowledge is subject to rejection or revision upon receipt of disconfirming evidence, right? And that means that all knowledge is provisional. It changes when new information comes to light. And that's how we should all be operating. And it's, you know, just because you're wrong today, it could have been that you were right yesterday. It's just, there's new information, there's new data, and we have to be open to it. And that's like my fundamental issue with this conversation. about housing.
Yeah, and there's a lot. Again, I agree. Well, as you already described our some of our interactions, I've always been one for kind of trying to understand and empathize with other people's perspectives. I think there's some of the ones, again, this idea of kind of provisional knowledge, I think is important, because it's also a lot of the theories that are used to support some of these. Like I would put supply and demand as a theory that, again, requires at least very, very critical understanding and dismantling to show when and how it works, what its simplifications are, what its assumptions are. That all of these different types of things, I think, are important to kind of bring back up. And I think they're, for better or worse, they are coming back up again hard, right? And again, it's because of a lot has changed. I would say, you know, in the past 20 years, 25 years, it's been, as we know, like the iPhone came out in 2007. Yeah, can you? And it's not like, if you look at it, it's only about 20 years ago, and like it has radically altered everything from apps, et cetera, access to information, data. All of this stuff is part of this package. And I think, again, that cultural shift is we're seeing now because of a lot of that information, some of these kind of high-held theories and laws being fundamentally dismantled. Literally, just it doesn't make sense. And why? And there's reams of data and writing. And there's one thing that I think is important within here, this, and I, it was great. I really appreciate it again when you were like, you know, kind of the responsibility, duty of care. I responded, I don't know whether you remember, I responded, well, we're, as the development industry that deals with hard materials, there's also a kind of duty of care in that, which I think is embedded in certain assumptions about that. But I think that every single thing is under siege right now. And I want to be clear. And the academic community is not kind of a protected little bubble. There's all types of AI, that how people are using it, the data, the pre-training, how data is being skewed because of that. There's kind of now fake data that within the academic world, it's like actually any trust that we had is now easily dismantled because some people are starting to publish things that aren't real anymore, right? So there's the kind of this weird moment where, you know, there's all types of crises are happening simultaneously, including within the academic industry, which again is kind of like trusted or not. I don't know. I've dealt with too many students that and they come in already and they're like, I don't trust you.
You're a few rungs above the developer on the ladder at the very least. On the trust ladder.
Well, you know, maybe we should get to the fundamental cause of Vancouver's housing affordability crisis, because, I mean, we've talked a lot about supply and demand. You kind of brought it up there as simple supply and demand doesn't really account for it. The letter was pretty clear. What was put forth in the letter that you signed was a very different understanding of why Vancouver is so unaffordable than I think we talk about often on the show. So maybe I'll put it as a question, which I have right here. What is the fundamental cause of Vancouver's housing affordability crisis?
I'll let you start with this one, because I'm gonna wind up going, and I'm gonna have, for the listeners, I'm having an internal crisis to throw out a bomb right now.
Just throw it.
So there's an easy answer and there's a difficult answer. An easy answer could be straightforward, you know, all the stuff that are mentioned in the letter. So you can talk about kind of supply, speed of delivery, the structural kind of demands of population, income, global flows, constraints, slow delivery costs, lands as assets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, amplifying speculation. And we can go into that. But I think I would be remiss, and I know that at least those who know me, if I didn't mention the following, is that there is a kind of structural and systemic, as I kind of just alluded to earlier before, that has kind of a pervasive social inequality associated with it. And this is where the bomb gets thrown. That's somehow, I'm going to be careful with my language here, that is related to the creation of physical and psychological harm based on force. And some people might call it a kind of structural violence. And what I mean by that, and I want to be very clear, that it's not kind of the sensationalized, you know, Avengers type smash and bang. And it's much more subtle. There's a subtlety, and I mentioned it before, between bureaucratic machinery, you know, who gets to go to certain tables, who doesn't, who's not in there, what is this based on, where the capital flow is coming from, what are the assumptions of that that are critical. So some of the things that I would say, for example, I'll give you one clear example, you know, and this is related but unrelated. So gross domestic GDP has a bunch of missing layers. So for example, it doesn't take energy use, it doesn't take material extraction as assumptions as a part of that calculation across the board. Shadow economy, unpaid care economies, this is not part of that thing.
Hey everyone, pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown, and we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure, an all-around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's J-E-T-H-R-O condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours.
And that is still used right now, as we know, as a general marker, despite the fact that we know that there are countries, et cetera, that with high GDPs that aren't necessarily great places to live. So I would say that the crisis kind of starts there. And it's, again, it starts centuries ago. And the mechanisms start being put in place. And that one of the mechanisms is based on, you know, idea of property rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that unfold in a very material way into a set of cultural beliefs. And that those beliefs wind up going and manifest in certain ways and approaches to the built environment, one of which is housing. And again, I'm not trying to be abstract here at all for the listener. There's nothing abstract about it. It's actually embedded in the physicality of a building. And I'll give you a clear example. So the carbon emissions in concrete and steel are well known right now, hands down. Like they could be calculated. I've calculated them myself. And that, as we know, is a tower is one of the highest embodied carbon house type forms on the planet that has ever been created in history. Yet we still propagate this. And the question would be then why? Like what? Who's benefiting? And that's where it kind of goes back to that this is the monster, right? That's the big monster in the room. It's like, where are these things coming from? Who's benefiting from them? Who is not? And who's being displaced? Who's not being considered? Whose voices are not being heard? I would say that that's the fundamental. Once you start zooming out, that is at least a big part of the issue of the crisis. And then we could get into kind of, this is how it manifests. And I think, again, things like speculation, investment, housing as a product, you know, how units are getting smaller and why, and foreign investment, and how does that play itself out? But I think that fundamentally, again, I'm going to throw this out and I'll leave it for both of you to either say, okay, I appreciate that and kind of move on, or to, which I will not blame you for because it's a lot. It's a lot. I just threw like a big thing out there. Or to say, look, you know, let's just focus kind of more on the details, which I'm 100% happy to do as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's been 20 years since I've taken a
higher level university class.
But you did a heck of a job, I'll tell you right now.
If I understand correctly, you're kind of identifying power dynamics in the marketplace. If I'm on a much more intellectual level than I can suggest, but. I guess, I mean, it's interesting, and it's something we don't talk about on the show a lot. And no. I guess the thing is it's weird because I'm sometimes confused about the different groups, the end goal, and how that informs the conversation. And what I mean by that is, I guess we're talking about affordability, right? And so, and I guess, I mean, I think, Bo, if I understand, like from your past times on the show, you're trying to look at ways that we can get the cost of housing down fundamentally, right? Correct. And I mean, maybe I'm trying to, because it sounds like maybe a fairly loose body of individuals that have signed, because you're saying they don't all agree.
No.
But what, I guess at the end is, was there an agreement in terms of getting, like making things more affordable, or like how does the power dynamic tie into that? Can you bridge that gap between the power dynamics and the affordability, just so it's maybe clear? I understand what you're saying to some extent. I just don't know necessarily how they connect. And I
appreciate that. So I think that the power dynamic happens, and again, there are very concrete forms. And just like we wound up saying, and these are all examples of it. So an example that you wound up saying is that we're not even at the table. Right. Remember you just a few minutes ago.
Right.
So the question is, okay, who the heck is at the table? And why are they at the table? And who is not at the table? And why are they not at the table? So there's very concrete things like that. Now, how does that play itself out in affordability is that the people at the table, for example, in this case, are people making decisions, right? About things that directly affect others. And those elements that affect others without sometimes informing them even becomes part of that system, the system of power. And I mentioned kind of harm, psychological harm. And we see this very clearly. We see this again recently in things like the Broadway plan, where, to be clear, I never asked for this position that I'm in, which is I write stuff and people tell me things and they throw me stuff. They throw me emails. But I have a stack of emails flagged and tagged with names, people inside different municipalities, literally their emails. And this is what they're saying and what they're doing and how they're acting to others and what they feel about other folks, about tenants, about, you know, people being displaced. I am seeing it physically. Like these are in black and white. And this is something that I think I have the honor and the privilege to have. And again, I never asked for it. It just seems to, when I think with anything, when
but emails write, from internally, like from cities and municipalities.
I cannot.
No, I know. But
yeah, but it is internal. So it's internal.
These are bureaucratic
systems. Got it. Even within different development groups and
development companies.
So these are the kind of things that, and they play themselves out. And I can't emphasize this enough that I'm not trying to be abstract here. They play themselves out in very real and physical terms. People are being, right now, displaced. And I'm looking at the letters from landlords. I'm looking at the letters from the city. And I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. Again, I never signed up for this. So the power dynamic makes its way down and it trickles to, you have to leave. And someone's saying, like, why do I have to leave? Et cetera, which is something like, for example, in the Broadway plan, where a policy is being done, certain people are not at the table. Those people are feeling the effects of that in very real ways. While I would argue many that made those decisions are not really feeling the effects at all.
So I guess one thing I'm just thinking about, and the Broadway plan is kind of an interesting point about it, but how do we, so we're in this very unaffordable place, right? And I think the and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, Bo, but the idea is, okay, we can kind of build our way out of this, right? We need more, and maybe not build our way out of this, but we need to move from four stories to 12, let's say. We need more housing. And in order to build more housing in, say, the city of Vancouver, in the Broadway Plan, we have to build on these places where renters are going to be displaced. So I'm kind of curious as to, is that the way to get out of affordability? Because one thing that struck me about the letter that you signed was, I don't even think you agree with that premise that you can build, that we need more housing in.
Well, that's a really great segue here. So first of all, I don't know, like building our way out of this, I don't know if it's as simple as that being the statement. Right. And there may have been a time, and in fact, I may have said it on this podcast. Yeah, we need to build more supply. And I don't think that, you know, the constituency understands visually what that supply looks like. Right. So CMHC is saying that we need 3.5 million homes than we already build to return to some level of affordability by 2032. That is a lot of housing. If most of it is going to be in Toronto and Vancouver, maybe Montreal, maybe Calgary, that's like people visually, you can't even contemplate that, right? And so that's one thing. So park that for a second, because I don't like building our way out of this is, I think, an oversimplistic sort of way to explain that. I think that what you just kind of, it's funny how you said that was a bomb that you were dropping them. It's like this, was it an existential bomb?
It's a very tangible material thing.
I thought he was going to put an email out there or something with something that I sent, like the premier of British Columbia, and there it is. Yeah. No, I think that my brain goes to funneling, distillation to first principles thinking. Right. And so if I put my philosophical hat on for a second, and I've said this to Eric, I do think that we rely too heavily on the private sector to deliver housing in Canada, right? And private capital. And I think the public sector, perhaps using private capabilities, can play a bigger role and in fact should. Right now, 95% of housing is delivered by the private sector in our country. That's the paradigm. So my issue is, back to first principles thinking, you can't change that paradigm overnight. You want to talk about power dynamics that have been going on for centuries, right? Like you said, like these are rooted in whatever they're rooted in, right? Like going back centuries, you know, the Torrens land system that created fee simple title or had a major component, like that, I don't know, like that's going back to the United Kingdom, I don't know how long. And that makes up our land title system today. And so you can have that conversation. But again, first principles, like we have a problem before us. And how do we attack that problem, right? How do we, and I don't want to call it an affordability crisis anymore, because you know what? It's not. It's a cost of delivery crisis. 40% now of the cost of new housing is in taxation, levies, and fees from various forms of government, and 7 to 10% making up that 40 is simple building code changes in the last 7 years. That is all government policy and complexity, which is something that Eric and I like to talk about using in that word, and Eric's really honing in on that. And so I like to drill into that. Right. Rather than have a conversation, and we can have that conversation about power dynamics, we can have I think that's a little bit obscure. I do think back to, you know, our paradigm in which we deliver housing in this country, our ecosystem, our housing ecosystem, that is a worthwhile conversation, but that's got to be a conversation that unfolds over a decade. What are we going to do right now? You want to drill into the Broadway plan? The Broadway plan was shit from day one. Like, honestly, the minute that they put a limit or block on the number of towers, it created a race for people to throw in an application to secure their spot, to secure their property having one of the two allowable towers on the block. What does it mean when you throw in an application, maybe with no intention of moving forward? It means you issue notice to the tenants of the old building, who then all of a sudden are like, holy fuck, I got to move. And they're freaking out. But the developer or the landowner may not have any intentions of moving forward. They're just trying to secure their entitlement because the planning department and the council of the day put this rule in place, which as soon as we saw that, we said, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's happening. Right. And so that's just shitty policy. That's just bad planning. That's simple. Right. So that's not power. I mean, maybe that's power dynamics. I don't know, but I know how to fix it. right? Right. And I think that we have to delineate the conversations. We have to say, okay, there's this big philosophical conversation about, you know, power dynamics, if you want to call it that, or the paradigm in which we deliver housing in our country. And then there's a conversation about what are we needing to do right now? And we have to have both at the same time.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that they're both happening simultaneously. I don't think, again, and sadly, I have to apologize if I am coming across as abstract and philosophical. But there's not, so when we go into, I'll take this as a little bit of an example. So CMHC's numbers have already been contested. There are actually three numbers that came out. One from the PBO, the Parliamentary Budgetary Office, another one from Oxford Economics, another one from CMHC. And then another one, I'm digging into Carolyn Weitzman's really interesting work that she wound up writing recently for another office, all of which have different numbers. So I was going through one of the articles that asked the CMHC person who came up with it. It's like, well, what's the deal with why is there a difference here? And then it was, well, actually, you know, they're using a more complex algorithm than I am. And I'm like, okay, so here we go. So what is real? What is not real? I have no idea, right? And if people are making policies and making decisions based on those numbers, then the implications become very real. So then we are getting, and I'm sure you've gotten all the numbers from CMHC, and you're making decisions based on those numbers. It's like, okay, this is what we have to do. And then solutions are coming out based on those numbers. Now, those numbers, I would argue, are abstractions to begin with, right? But the key thing around that is that what isn't included in those numbers? Like, where did those numbers come from? And, you know, I don't want to pick on the Broadway plan, but I will. Okay, I will. But for example, for the Broadway plan, from what I understand, I have heard even internally and externally that no one actually, before the plan, figured out what the capacity was to begin with. And number two, what the kind of the existing tenancy rates, the numbers. Now, I've heard a bunch of numbers. So one of the recent ones I heard that was actually by a wonderful person by the name of Sandy James, and she was on Jill Bennett just earlier this week, about some of the numbers that another person by the name of Ralph Siegel came out with, is that it would take 150 towers to replace, if you kind of wiped out all of the Broadway plan, the existing rental, to replace what was existing. And so 150 towers to replace. And again, to be clear, listeners, I have not double-checked this. This is all rolling in as daily new things are coming into me. But I think that even if it's a fraction of that, that's where it becomes real, right? Like and people are making land entitlements, they're purchasing, they're getting people out. So that's where I'm trying to say is that it's not abstract. It's actually very, very real. And people are making decisions.
But so you're saying the numbers are 150 towers?
I think it was that.
Would just replace the existing housing stock.
Yeah. In that area, it's 500 blocks. That's a heck of a lot. And if you go into the different neighborhoods, it spans a lot of existing rental. And again, listeners, don't hold me to it right now. I have to wind up going and I have to double check. But I believe it was somewhere within that realm. So it was an exorbitant number. And I think that that's where these things become real, right? That's where
that's the tangible policy that has the tangible impact, the physical impact.
The physical impact, that's sure. Right.
You know, I think that I agree with you on CMHC, right? Like, I don't know that they have a rationale for those numbers. They can explain it to you. They're using immigration. They're using house formation. They're right. And you can choose to believe in those numbers or not. And I don't know if I do or not, right? There are other numbers. Mike Moffitt's come out with a reanalysis what our needs are. What I do believe is we are undersupplied in Canada for housing. And I also believe that we are not making babies in Canada, and therefore we are going to need to grow our population somehow to maintain our place as a G7 economy and a G7 nation. Therefore, that will occur through some form of immigration program in the future, even though there's stuff going on there now. And therefore, we are going to need to build housing for new household formation, right? Like that is back to first principles thinking. And so we have to deliver housing. You know, I think back to the Broadway plan, back to displacement. Displacement's a very real thing. I've said it on this podcast before, I think, and said it many times publicly. People who lose their home and are displaced, They are displaced from their community, their doctor, their church, maybe their children's school. That is the unraveling of community fabric and the strength of fabric, right? And I think that that's a very real problem. With this said, we can't state that without asking the question, how are we going to maintain that aging stock that is our so cherished affordable stock, right? How are that letter, we must preserve the aging and affordable stock at all costs. Okay, here's our portfolio of aging rental stock. 5-year average, 77% increase in operating costs, 8% increase in revenue. That is unsustainable. And our policymakers refuse to have a conversation about that. And the tenant advocacy groups refuse to acknowledge that, in fact, and CMHC has a report here that talks about evictions, and across the country, they're 1% to 3%. And so whether you believe that number or not, I haven't dug into the data there. But I think that my qualitative observation is that evictions, demo evictions, rent evictions are way down because the policies put in place are so restrictive in terms of what you can and can't do with a rental unit that it's virtually impossible to even get a tenant out for not paying rent at this point. So I guess we have to have, this is what we always do, right? We have these conversations in silos. We must build more housing. We must preserve aging rental stock. We must, you know, and it's never this balanced conversation. Well, okay, if we're going to do that, well, we have to address this as well. It's always that. Mm-hmm. You can't have one or the other. And that's what drives me crazy about this housing conversation. And as far as aging rental stock, that's the biggest conversation I want to have right now.
And that's critical. Like, I think that as you know, and we've discussed this, and I've seen your numbers. You showed me kind enough to show the numbers and in terms of kind of the maintenance and operation of these things. And again, when you punch in the numbers, 100%, they make zero sense. And this is where I think maybe it goes back to the beginning, this idea of collaboration. I think that the numbers have to go in. And then the question becomes, okay, so what do we do about it? Right?
Should rents go up?
Well, so, or can the federal government start playing more of a hand in actual housing instead of what, you know, when they pulled out. So now we could go into the power dynamics of why they pulled out and who was influencing that. I'll bypass that for now. But the idea is that they did pull out, 80s went down, private sector took over. And that's a reason to a large degree why we are where we are. Now we're at a kind of moment where it's like, okay, you know, what do we do about it? So now it's not working out necessarily. The numbers aren't working out in real terms. Like, concrete, the numbers don't work. I agree 100%. So then the question becomes what to do about it, right? Do we demolish the whole thing? Do we take out 500 blocks of the, you know, along Broadway, including the existing? Do we displace people? Or if not, what is the alternative? So then the alternative starts saying, okay, if now, what can we do now and not in 10 years or 20 years or whatever? And part of the things is, you know, I would say, hey, feds, time for you to come back in the game. Like, you can't just kind of say, now you went, we had this wonderful experiment. You know, the private sector took up, you know, the 95%, according to Bo here. And now this is where we're at. Now, you're complicit as much as anybody else here, government. So what has to happen? Well, you have to kick in. You have to start playing more of an active role in this. You can't kind of just kind of say, because then it becomes it's a weird kind of dynamic. So the government say, hey, you know, the private sector. Private sector, they're not doing their job. Private sector is like, hey, you know, we're doing our job. You're not doing the job. And it becomes this cyclical thing. When if you go back and you go back into kind of the dynamics of it, I think the key thing is that in any one of the places, and I've done a number of in-field studies, like I've wrote a whole series on Singapore, a whole series on Barcelona, the federal government, the government is a huge part of the solution. Right. And because markets are notoriously volatile, right? They're unpredictable. We know this, that if you want something that's steady and stable, you don't really want to rely on a market, especially not now. So that means that there has to be a stabilizer. And that stabilizer, I would argue, is kind of the government.
But what about for the existing stock? So
the existing stock, I think, again, I would say that there has to be a really meaningful conversation between all the parties involved, including the government, including, like, I think, again, that, you know, there's this idea, and it says it in the letter, that this is an opportunity to potentially buy back some things, right? To take that back and say, okay, you know what? We're taking it off your hand.
Does the government have the expertise to do that?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, here we go. Now,
no, I'm just...
Well, but so I have some strong feelings. So the Rental Protection Fund, which, you know, both the provincial government and the federal government are playing in. And indeed, 50%, I believe, of aging apartment building transactions in British Columbia in 2024 were from the Rental Protection Fund, which is the province giving money to nonprofits to go buy these old buildings. You know, and they tout this as this great sort of, you know, we're winning, we're preserving this aging rental stock. So that building doesn't discriminate against who owns it in terms of the problems that it has that need to be fixed.
Yep.
So whether it's the government owning it through a nonprofit or a private sector or a mom and pop or a REIT or whatever, the boiler still needs to be replaced because it's old. The roof needs to be replaced because it's old. The masonry fell off the building because it's almost 80 years old, right? So that we're putting taxpayers' dollars to buy these old buildings with, is there a preservation strategy? Is there a CapEx strategy? And okay, so say, yes, we have a CapEx strategy. We know they're aging. We're also going to provide an operating annuity. Okay, so now you're creating a market that's unfair and uneven because you put two buildings side by side, one's owned by the mom and pop and one's owned by the nonprofit sponsored by government. The mom and pop have no ability to invest in the building and the government's just going to keep shelling money in. And I call bullshit, right? So, okay, Bo, then what's the fix? What's the answer? And this is where I go back. So let's go back to CMHC for a second. And let's go back to the filtering concept in housing, right? And CMHC has actually done a great job of explaining filtering within the housing ecosystem. And what that essentially is that when new supply comes online, people from old supply move to the old supply, and it unlocks old supply for people who are unhoused or somewhere else in the housing ecosystem to move into. And we see this unfolding in submarkets right now because, so CMHC very much believes, they believe in their numbers, okay? They also believe in filtering. So what they've done is all of their policy is dropping out of those two beliefs. And with what is formerly the RCFI program and now the ACLP program, which stands for Apartment Construction Loan Program, those programs have, in fact, produced the most amount of purpose-built rental housing through loans, not grants, loans that need to be paid back with interest. Carolyn Wiseman, you said her name earlier. She seems to characterize that money as grants, and it's not. It's loans that we put up our balance sheet for and covenants and guarantee. And that's delivered the most amount of purpose-built rental housing since the MERBs. So, you know, the MERBs was the most post-World War II, and now ACLP RCFI is the most since MERBs. And so what you're seeing in these submarkets where these new ACLP projects are coming on, and we're seeing it within our own portfolio. We build a new building next to or not far from some of our old buildings, and people are jumping ship. And guess what we're doing with the older buildings? This is the beauty. We're inducing tenants. Take a couple of free months rent. We got to lease this thing up. Oh, parking that we used to charge for because rental supply was more restricted, it's now free. Like the system is working. The filtering concept within the housing ecosystem is unfolding before our very eyes. And so, you know, back to how do we preserve the aging stock? I think over time, we move people out of the aging stock. And the aging stock comes to the end of its useful life. We acknowledge it and we rebuild. But right now, we're not rebuilding fast enough and it's causing displacement. Or we're planning in areas that are, you know, for renewal where there's high levels of this affordable aging stock. And mm-hmm. I think that's David Lay's kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem for sure.
Yeah.
But that's my kind of diatribe on like the system and what's going on. And I do think it's working, in fact, at a broad level.
So I would agree and disagree in certain
you
kind
can't
of specific.
Disagree,
yeah,
no.
I can't. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to.
So there you have it, folks. part one of our discussion with the editor-in-chief of Spacing Vancouver and lecturer at UBC, Eric Villagomez, and the CEO and president of West Group, Bo Jarvis.
Yeah, really enjoyed having both of them on the show. We are actually renting, well, longtime listeners of the show will remember our producer. He used to have a spot at the table, often was the butt of a few jokes. Our good friend Brady D, we were taking over the studio with them. So we really appreciate the use of the space. And yeah, I think a great conversation.
Oh yeah, we should. We do appreciate Podfather Brady D.
Yeah, no, that was good. It was a lot of fun. So next week we got part two, Matt. We've also got a lot of exciting shows coming in the near future. A lot of like really pragmatic stuff. We've got Richard Bell from Bell Alliance coming on the show to talk about estate planning and how real estate ties into that. So really info-packed session coming up with Richard Bell. And you know, when you think of real estate law and Vancouver, Bell Alliance is almost synonymous with real estate law in the city, right? Like they're kind of very well known. So great to have Richard coming on the show. Who else do we got? We got some great episodes coming. We got Dustin Woodhouse coming back, which is super exciting.
Yeah, I'm working on getting a divorce lawyer on. I'll just leave it.
Hopefully not on the payroll.
Not for me. Me, of course.
On the show.
But we've never talked about the complications and considerations
of divorce.
Of divorce and real estate, which so I'm working on that right now. I don't wanna throw anybody's name out yet, but he's big.
Oh, great. Well, fantastic. Well, we've got a ton of great shows coming up, but next week we're back with second part of Eric Villagomez and Bo Jarvis. A friendly debate.
And Adam, as a final note, of course, we have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. We've sort of slowed down on PCS. I'm not sure why, because people keep signing up. It's a fantastic resource. It's over at VancouverRealEstate.com, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. We have the Livewire. This is our weekly mailer. What we want more than anything right now is if you're finding value in this show, enjoying the show, please either review or pass it along to a friend. If you're finding the debate exciting or interesting, share it with a friend or family member. That would be fantastic for us. And if you want to talk about that or anything else at any time, we're excited to talk to you. And you can try me at 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that info at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com line that we call the Kokomo line. And we'll leave it there, Adam. And we're looking forward to part two next week.
Take care. Hot Shots part two.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.